Okay. Good morning, and welcome to week 3 of 4, Game of Thrones, the Persian Empire edition. This week, as I titled it at the top of your sheet, Ahasuerus the Anxious. If anyone doesn't have a sheet, I think they're over there on the table with the hot water. Again, grateful to Beth Emeth for hosting, Ron Becker for dedicating, and please make sure if you have a phone with you to make it silent. My usual preface: this is not an endorsement of the television show, which I have never seen. Based on my knowledge of its contents, I will not see. And again, they're not endorsing the series either. I put an outline at the top of a sheet, the Four Kings, because as I've been going through week by week and preparing this, I've noticed a structure that I thought might be there from the beginning, but now I really see it better. And that is, in the fourth king, obviously, someone we'll have to see next week. But, you know, with Darius the Mede, we saw a king who was railroaded, right? In the sense that this was the fellow who took power at the age of 62, the fellow who had no interest in running the empire himself, but instead he appointed people. He had 120 sub-rulers, if you will, or satraps who served under him, and they reported to three people who reported to him, and he wanted to put Daniel in charge of everything. And the members of his court, in a conspiracy to try to bring down Daniel, railroad him. They railroad Darius into creating a situation in which Daniel will get caught up in the plot, right? They say everybody has to come to you for 30 days, and something which really is clearly against the king's grain, and he doesn't want Daniel to be thrown to the lions. We saw that the first week. It's a king being pushed by others into a terrible situation. The second is a king who is manipulated, and that was last week. We talked about Cyrus the Great, who thinks he is manipulating others, right? He writes letters to the Babylonians when he conquers them, writes letters to the Jews when he conquers them, saying that I am the anointed one of your God, and I am going to restore your worship with the Babylonians. He says that the Babylonian God has chosen him. With the Jews, he says that the Jewish God has chosen him, and he allows us to build the temple. But as it's presented in Tanakh, he's actually being manipulated by God. Instead of Darius, who's being manipulated by his court, Cyrus is being manipulated by God, who predicted his selection and his anointing long before Persians were even on the scene. That was last week. This week we see Ahasuerus. And Ahasuerus, as I wrote on your sheet, is afraid. And we're going to see that fear on multiple levels, but this is somebody who is governed by his emotions and principally by fear. And then when we get to Artaxasta, we see somebody for whom the sages struggle to figure out what is it that makes him do what he does. What is it that motivates him? And you know, we'll see more about him, God willing, next week. But right now, we have to focus on Ahasuerus. Now, there's a real challenge here in terms of saying anything about Ahasuerus, because we learn the story when we're kids, and we hopefully renew the story year after year, and it grows with us, and we grow with it. And there's a range of knowledge reflected among the people who are here in this room. And it's hard to say something that will actually be new for people, but I think I do have something. First, in terms of Ahasuerus' identity, you know, among the Persian kings, there's some confusion in this regard. There's no question that Ahasuerus is after Cyrus has already expanded the empire and conquered Babylon, right? He doesn't conquer 127 nations himself, right? Like it's in the biblical text, in the text in Esther, right? It says that he has 127 lands under his control. That's not because he did anything. You know, he falls into that. Cyrus did the hard work. At the same time, Mordecai and Esther are living in what had been Babylon, what is now Persia. right? Even though Cyrus has licensed the Jews to come back to Israel. That says something. Why is Mordechai still living in Persia at this point? Not only that, we don't know where Ezra and Nehemiah are. Ezra and Nehemiah are going to be two of the major leaders of the Jews who go back to Israel, but they don't go back in the beginning. They don't go back when Jews first come back under Cyrus. So are Ezra and Nehemiah living in Babylon in Persia at this point, and they're just not mentioned in the story? Or is this story decades later, decades after Cyrus, in which case they're actually back in Israel, and that's why they don't feature in this story? There's even an idea in the Midrash that Mordechai and Ezra may have an association with each other. They may be the same person. It's a little bit unclear. So the result of this is we don't know how long this is after Cyrus. Ahasuerus' name actually shows up in one sentence in the fourth chapter of Ezra, but that chapter itself is difficult in terms of when the events of that chapter take place. So just in terms of orienting us where we are after Cyrus from last week. Ezra might be back in Israel already, leading the Jews religiously. Nehemiah might be back in Israel as the political leader. We don't know. What that also means is we don't know if the Beit HaMikdash, the temple, has already been fully rebuilt. We don't know if Jerusalem has its walls, the defenses, all of the events that are supposed to take place in that period. It's very unclear. The Book of Esther doesn't give us enough detail to work with. Okay, so much for history. The story of Ahasuerus that we're going to see here, I'm going to try to tell in three levels, three layers. First, fear as the driver of the basic narrative, followed by some of the key plot twists in the story and the way that they are influenced by fear. And then the Midrash, how the rabbis amplified elements of the story in order to highlight the fear that drives Ahasuerus. Just a quick show of hands type of question. Have you ever thought about Ahasuerus in terms of fear?
No.
What do we usually think of as the motivator for the king in this story? Power.
Pride.
Lust. That's more or less the way we think of him normally. But, yeah.
Very despotic.
Oh, yeah. No, I made a rule. You can't change it. I have a rule that nobody's allowed to come into my throne room, right? If you enter my throne room without being invited, off with your head. Despot is, I think, a decent word for him. But like many despots, he is fear-driven. And we're going to see this very clearly in the story. I wanted to show you sources 1 and 2 as the opener to this. There's a classic Talmudic debate about Ahasuerus. You may have heard it at some point. Is Ahasuerus a wicked king, or is Ahasuerus a foolish king? Is he wicked or is he foolish? Now, obviously the most directly relevant aspect of that is the decision to destroy the Jews, right? His approval of Haman's plan. Is it that he's a terrible person and he buys into the plan because he hates Jews? Or is it simply that Haman has a plot and takes advantage of the fact that he can make Ahasuerus do whatever he wants? Right, traps him essentially.
Manipulates him.
So take a look at source number 1, please, where the Talmud introduces this question in a separate context, not in terms of the Jews. This is towards the beginning of the book. In the third year of his reign, right, this is the third year of King Ahasuerus, he prepared a feast for all of his officers and servants, the administration of Persia and Media, the Partamim. Partamim we'll see a few times here. It's a term for some level of officer. The Partamim, the officers of the lands before him, to display the wealth of the honor of his reign and the glorious splendor of his greatness for many days, 180 days. Now that's a party, right? That's the way to do a feast. 180 days. You have to pace yourself, I think. But he makes this great big feast. And at the conclusion of these days, the king prepared for the entire nation found in the capital, Shushan, from great to small, a party for 7 days in the yard of the palace garden. 180-day party, then a 7-day party. What's the difference in the clientele of the two parties? So one difference is that the first party is described as being for his officers and servants, the administration of Persia and Media, Partimim, and officers. These are the elite. And the second one is the entire nation found in the capital in Shushan. That's one distinction. What's the other distinction?
The rich and the poor.
But that was that's the first one. The first one is the elite. The second is the general population. But what else do you see here? Well, it's in the yard. I think it's as opposed to doing it with the glorious splendor of the palace. That's the location. But in terms of the clientele, right? The first party is for the administration from all the lands before him, taking from everywhere. The second party is for the locals. What's the logic? What's the logic in having in having two separate parties? I understand, because your first one is the elite, and you want them to feel that way. And your second party is going to be to take care of the locals. And I understand that you want to do a party for the locals. You don't want them to be angry that here you made this big feast and you brought in all the dignitaries from out of town and you created traffic jams and it's a big mess, right? And you're not going to do something for them. So I get that you want to do something for the locals as well. I certainly get that you don't want the locals for 180 days. You see them all the time. 7 days, fine. I did my job. But the Talmud picks up on the order. The fact that he first does a party for all the elite, all the administration from elsewhere, and then after that does the local party, as opposed to flipping it, locals first. What's the logic in doing the first party for the elite and the second party for your locals?
Well, he doesn't have to impress the locals, and he does the elite.
So he has to impress the elite, so therefore he's going to put them first.
He's a despot, so he can do what he likes with the locals, but he doesn't have to impress them.
Right. So Marilyn says he can get away with doing whatever he wants, but the locals push them to be after the 180 days. Judith?
Consolidating his power.
Consolidating his power? What do you mean?
Well, the first one would be consolidating his power with the elite.
Yeah. And then once you've consolidated your power, then you can take care of the locals. So the locals don't have as much of a claim on him, and they're not as necessary for his plans. Okay, Mordechai.
Just to follow that up, he needs the administrators and the officers and the civil servants from 127 other states. He needs their loyalty in order to preserve his reign, to consolidate his power. 180 days, 127 states, there's a lot of travel. So
right.
It wasn't 180 days for all of the people. There had to be a revolving door because the administrators couldn't be away for a half a year.
Right. Can you take everybody out of their lands, 127 lands, for half a year? Right. Presumably, some of them are showing up and some of them are leaving, or they have some really good deputies. The other thing, though, that Mordechai just noted is he's consolidating his power. But when is this happening?
The third year
of his reign.
Yeah.
You're 3 years in, and now you're consolidating your power. What does that speak to?
There may be rumblings in this.
There's something going on, right? This is one of the things that leads the Talmud. We're not going to get into this point specifically, but worth noting, the Talmud has a suggestion that the third year of his reign is the 70th year after the Jews had been exiled. And so the idea is he's celebrating the completion of the 70 years and saying, look, the Jews are still living in my lands. They haven't gone back to their lands. What that passage is trying to do is to figure out why you consolidate your power with this big party 3 years in. It's an odd time to do this. Mush.
I think it was Machiavelli who said, keep your friends close and your enemies closer.
Right. So you've accomplished keeping your friends close and your enemies closer by inviting your enemies first, or potential enemies first. Right. Well, take a look at source number two. This is the Talmud's observation on this. And at the conclusion of these days, etc., Rav and Shmuel debated. One said he was a wise king. The other said he was a foolish king. The one who said he was a wise king said he did well, drawing near the distant first. For he can always appease the residents of his city, right? As was suggested here. The locals, I can always take care of them. Let me first worry about the dignitaries from elsewhere. The one who said he was foolish said he should have drawn the residents of his city near first. For if the others would rebel, these would stand with him. Right? If some outlying land decides they want to break away, it's not as immediate a threat. If the locals don't like him, he's vulnerable. And so therefore this was foolish. It wasn't a smart decision. That's one passage. I'm going to see another one in a moment. But what is the Talmud here trying to accomplish with this analysis of his methodology? Is it trying just to teach me a lesson? Like, if you ever happen to be king, here's what you ought to do? Or is it trying to tell me something about Ahasuerus, about the way he goes about his actions? Yeah, Marilyn.
Isn't he being a true diplomat? It may have been a conspiracy. He knows that countries are going to be against him. He's trying to get there first before anything happens. It could be a coup.
Right.
But the locals aren't that powerful, I think.
Well, we don't know. I mean, they are living in the capital, and the capital tends to attract people who are trying to get involved in the government. That's usually the way capitals work.
At the first level and have more power. There may be a conspiracy, and he knows.
Right. I think that what you started with, I think, is the key. His actions are purposeful. He may be wrong. He may make a bad decision. But when you look at what Ahasuerus does in this book, you have to ask yourself, what is moving him? You can't just read it as, and then he did this, and then he did this, and then he did this. There's a cause and effect here. He may make bad decisions, but he has a reason for what he does. And if you look at the motivation that they assign here, his motivation is indeed often fear. Trying to draw people around him and trying to forestall the inevitable rebellion. Mordechai, you were going to say? Or?
No, I'm just going to echo it. It wasn't the party 180 days and the 7 days. It wasn't simply for Hedonism. There was a pragmatic purpose.
Right. Right. He's not just trying to have a drink fest. That isn't really the only driver of what he's doing. There's a similar idea elsewhere. I brought you source number 3. This is a completely different story. King Chizkiyahu is the king of the southern kingdom, Judea, based in Jerusalem, about midway through the first temple period. The Assyrians invade. And the Assyrians send a message to the Jews saying the following. Source number 3. Do not listen to Hezekiah, for so declares the king of Assyria. This is propaganda. Give me a gift and come out to me. And each will eat of his grapevine and each his fig tree and each will drink the water of his cistern until I come take you to a land like your own. A land of grain and wine, a land of bread and vineyards, a land of oil producing olives and honey. And you shall live and not die. Do not listen to Chizkiah, for he seduces you, saying, God will save us. It's an attempt to get the Jews to, instead of holding out against the invasion, to get them to capitulate. The Assyrian method of conquest is, as we said last week, to transfer populations. So he says, everything will be good. There's going to be no brutal invasion. You'll have your land, you'll have your fields, you'll be doing well, and then one day, I'm going to move you to a land just like yours. And, sorry?
Sounds like Hitler.
Yes.
I'm going to every pot, and I'm going to move the Jews to another country, and you'll know whether you can take off.
This has always been the propaganda. So take a look at source number 4, where you find the same two sages debating. Rav and Shmuel debated. One said he was a wise king. Sanherib, the Assyrian king, was a wise king. The other said he was a foolish king. The one who said he was a wise king said that he thought, if I tell them it's better than your land, they'll say I'm lying. So he said, a land like your own. They'll say I'm exaggerating otherwise. They won't trust me. And the one who said he was a foolish king said, if so, meaning the lands are equal, then what would be the advantage of that land? And why should we go along with this? If we're not going to be trading up, why would we trade? Either way, what they're trying to show you is the actions of kings are calculated, They may be smart, they may not be smart, but the actions are calculated, and that's what we see with Ahasuerus here. Okay, so this is what we're going to see with Ahasuerus's decisions. We will see them as purposeful and, generally speaking, a reaction to fear. Let's go with the most basic level of the story first and then build our way upward. The story begins with Ahasuerus's party. I'm assuming some familiarity, but we're going to go through the story, and so for those who may not remember all the details, we'll pick up on them as we go through. So it's 3 years into Ahasuerus's reign. He throws a big party for the entire empire, or the leadership of the entire empire, I should say, for 180 days. Then he throws a second party for the locals, the city of Shushan, for 7 days, like we discussed. Then at the second party, he summons Queen Vashti. She is to be on display for everybody, and she refuses. Ahasuerus is angry. He takes it up with his political advisors, and the advice which he accepts is to remove her monarchy. It doesn't actually say she's dead, which is convenient for kindergarten teachers when they teach this story. We don't really like to talk about what happened to Vashti, but you know that there's no such thing as an ex-queen in the Persian Empire. And so he removes her from the throne, and he decrees empire-wide that women must listen to their husbands, which answers the question of whether he was a wise king or a foolish king. So here's a question for you. Go back to source number one in the description of the party. What is the goal of the party as presented in the text of that 180-day party? To display his wealth. Seriously? You need 180-day, a six-month party, right? To demonstrate your wealth? Who does that? Yeah, Louis the 14th. Did he do a 180-day party? Hey, good furniture.
As was mentioned, it took a long time to travel from point A to point B.
Right.
So maybe the 180 days was to take into consideration the length of time
right.
It would have taken people to
cook. Right. Ruth's point is well taken. I think, as we had noted, travel time and schedules may be a factor, especially when you're dealing with administration. This is true. I think, though, yeah, Marilee.
Just thinking of Vashti, because she would be part of the wealth on display.
Yes.
If she was not asked to be part of the 180 days, but was only asked for the second party, I wouldn't go with her.
That's it. She's upset at being part of the second party. There you go.
She's not mentioned as part of the wealth.
Right. No, she actually had a party of her own, as the text says. Gam Vashti Amalkas Estamishte Nashin. Vashti had made her own party. But that's one piece of it. The other piece... Yeah.
Displayed so many times.
She's tired already. This could be. But what you're seeing here, I think the point about the 180 days having practical purpose, I think is valid. But I think the fact that he needs to make this party demonstrates a level of insecurity right off the bat. But more to the point, look at source number 5. After Vashti has refused, and the king said to the wise men, and we get a list of the wise men, regarding what to do of Queen Vashti, for she had not performed the word of King Ahasuerus through his officers. And the advice he gets, which he approves, is that he should do the following. If it is good to the king, let the royal word go forth before him. Let it be recorded in the laws of Persia and Media without violation that Vashti did not come before King Ahasuerus, and the king shall give her reign to her peer who is better than her. And he goes on about how women have to listen to their husbands and so forth. Tell me something. What kind of a fool does it take that the queen refuses your order and it's embarrassing to you, and so you turn it into an international political incident to tell the whole world that she refused to listen to you? I had an incident that happened when I was a shul rabbi, where there was something that had occurred in the community, and there were some families that were upset about the event that had taken place, and I was going to speak about it from the pulpit. We had in the shul somewhere around 250 families, and I was talking to somebody who was involved in the story, and I said, I really think I should speak about the issue, and he said to me, what percentage of the shul do you think is involved with this right now? I said, probably, I don't know, 10% of the shul, 20 families or so. He said, you know, if you speak about it from the pulpit, then 100% are going to be involved. You don't win by doing that. You're not going to accomplish what you think you're accomplishing. What you've done instead is you've created a cause empire-wide in his case. So why does he do that? Morris.
I don't know if there's any basis for this, but marriages in those times weren't necessarily just marriages, especially kings. I mean, Vashti was the daughter of...
We'll get there. We'll get there. Maybe.
I just say, like, she may have had her own power base, and to remove her from power, he needed to...
A reason
that, and, you know, hypothesized the reason why he's devoted.
Right. So Morris points out in Midrash that we're going to get to, that is bothered by exactly this question of why in the world does he blow this story up? Why does he want to tell everybody about it? And indeed, that's what the Talmud is trying to do, is to try to provide an explanation for the fear that Ahasuerus feels. Why is he so afraid that he has to do this? And the answer is, because of who she is, she actually presents a threat to his kingdom. We'll talk about that when we get to the third layer. But on a basic level, this simply demonstrates insecurity. That's what this shows. He's so insecure that he is going to have to take care of this, and he's going to use a hammer to take care of a job that really doesn't need one. And so he says, I'm going to replace Vashti. And that's in chapter 2. They look for young, attractive girls to audition for Ahasuerus. There are actually two different groups that are described in the text. Some are young and single. Some are not necessarily single. Each of them is supposed to surrender 1 year of her life for preparation for this, as it's described in the text. And it's one of those verses that people just sort of gloss over, because they're focused on getting to the plot and the story and everything else. But when you actually look at it, you realize they spend Shishah Hadashim B'Shemen Hamor V'Shishah Hadashim B'Abesamim 6 months in one type of bath, 6 months going through other types of beauty treatments, a year, in order to go into the king, after which she either becomes the queen or is consigned to the harem forever. There is no such thing as going back to life after that. All of these women who are going to Ahasuerus are now stuck. They're going to live in the palace, in the compound, whatever it is. Esther, first cousin of Mordechai, is brought to the king. She hides her Jewish identity. We'll talk about that later. She finds favor in the eyes of the king, and lo and behold, she becomes queen. End of chapter 2, there's an interlude, a very important interlude. There's a plot on the life of Ahasuerus. Bigtan and Teresh, palace officers, are angry at Ahasuerus. They plot against the king. Mordechai finds out, he tells the queen, and Bigtan and Teresh are executed, and the event is duly recorded in the king's chronicles. Okay, chapter 3. We're going to come back to chapter 2. It's really important, but just we're not ready for it yet. Ahasuerus elevates Haman, who wants to kill the Jews. He gives Haman absolute power, demands absolute obedience from the population for him. Mordechai refuses to bow to Haman, gets Haman angry. Haman sells Ahasuerus on eliminating the Jews as a threat to his authority. He says, listen, I'll pay you 10,000 silver coins. Ahasuerus declines the cash. That's all right, I'm good. All right, take a look at source number 6 from the third chapter. And the king said to Haman, the money is given to you and the nation to do with as is good in your eyes. Do what you want. You notice that? He rejects the money. Why did he reject the money? You're Ahasuerus. You have to plan for your next 180-day party. What are you doing? Why did you reject the money?
He wants to make Haman feel good.
He wants to make Haman feel good? I think elevating him to be the top man, already kind of did that. What was Haman's sales pitch to get rid of the Jews? Do you remember? It wasn't about revenue. Sorry?
Revenue
neutral. It wasn't that kind of pitch. What did he say? Right. We're going to come back to his pitch later on, but what he says to Ahasuerus is, Yeshno amechad mefuzar meforad beinu amim. There is a nation that is scattered among your lands, Their laws are different from yours. They don't listen to the king's laws. The king, it's not worth it for you to leave them around. That's the revenue neutral argument. It's not worthwhile for you to have these people who are trouble. And that statement that these Jews are trouble is what leads Ahasuerush to say, not only get rid of them, but I'm going to pay for it. I'm willing to pay for this. Again, it's the element of fear that Haman is playing with. So Mordechai finds out. He goes to Esther for help. Esther refuses because going to the king without being invited is fatal. She says, I haven't been invited in 30 days, which either means I'm out of favor with the king or I'm due to be invited soon. But I'm not willing to go in. Finally, Mordechai convinces her to go. He says, God's going to take care of us. I'm not so sure about you. She says, all right, fine, but I want a 3-day national fast. But that rule of Ahasuerush, that rule that nobody gets to go into the palace, right, into his throne room without being invited, right? Source number 7. All of the king's servants in the nations of the lands of the king know that any man or woman who comes to the king to the inner yard who has not been called, there is but one law, to kill him. Is that a good way to run a kingdom? Right. That's fear talking, right? This is not a healthy way to run a government.
But that was not a common nation concept, the same in China. You couldn't come in to see the emperor unless you were called.
And what's the motivation there? Right, protection. It's all about fear. It isn't productive, but it is defensive. That's really what this is about. It's about it's about avoiding the possibility that somebody comes in and attacks. He is living in fear. Well, Esther goes in, right? Ahasuerush likes her, and Ahasuerush says, source number 8, the king said to her, what do you want, Queen Esther? What is your request? Up to half the kingdom, it shall be done. Is that a good request? Is that a good offer?
No, he's just covering himself.
Just a magnanimous gesture.
Well, you could read it two ways, right? Either you could say, I'll give you up to half the kingdom, or you could say, I'm giving you up to half the kingdom. Right? Two ways you could look at it. I think that the way to read it, in fact, is I can only give you up to half. I am not willing to give you more than half. There's a limit to my magnanimity. So Esther invites Ahasuerush and Haman to a party. Right? She's going to make her request there. Then at the first party, she says, he hasn't had enough to drink yet. I'm going to invite him to a second party. And there I'll really make my request. And Haman is feeling good until he sees Mordechai, and he gets angry when he sees Mordechai refused to bow to him, and he comes home and he tells his friends, and they say, well, you should have Mordechai killed. And that's what Haman's plan becomes. But tell me something. Source number 9 is where she says to invite Haman. Right? If I have found favor in the eyes of the king, and if it is good before the king to grant my wish and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come to the party I shall prepare for them. Why is she inviting Haman to the party? Yeah. You could give a few different explanations for why she invites Haman. One is the king, keep your enemies closer. This way Haman won't realize anything is up. And that may be part of it. Plus, it sets up a great scene at the end when she points him out. But fundamentally, the rest of the story is driven by Ahasuerush's fear of Haman. That's where this story goes. And so she is playing on that insecurity. Why is my queen, who has a request for me that is so important to her that she endangered her life to make it, why is she inviting Haman to this party? I'm the king, right? She should be talking to me. So that's the that's what she's playing with, is that fear of in this case fear of Haman. Well, Ahasuerush can't sleep. Ahasuerush is unable to sleep, and part of that inability to sleep is this fear that is driving him. He is afraid of being attacked, and you'll see that shortly. So he says, you know what, I need to be able to sleep. Read me the chronicles. Read me the records. Not as a cure for insomnia, But read me the records, there's something there, and we'll see more about what he's looking for. But they find that Mordechai had saved the king, and he had not been rewarded. Yes, you know, what was done for him, nothing was done for him. Who's outside? He asks. Who's in my yard? And of course, in his yard is Haman, who has come to get permission to hang Mordechai. And the king asks him, without yet knowing what he's there for, the king asks him, how do I reward somebody if I want to give somebody honor? And Haman assumes it's himself. Right? As it says in the text, he said, you know, who else could it be? It's got to be me. And he says, give royalty to that person. Take the king's horse, which usually trots out with the king's crown on its head, and take the royal garb, and that's how you should dress up this person. And Ahasuerus says, give the horse and the garb to Mordechai and have Haman lead the horse through the street. And that is indeed what happens. Haman comes home very angry, and Haman's friends say, you know, you're in trouble now. Right? Go to source number 10, please. That night the king's sleep was shaken. He said to bring the book of records, the accounts of days that were read before the king. He can't sleep. I believe, again, this is a function of fear, such that it was found recorded that Mordechai had told of Bigtan and Teresh, that story from chapter 2. Two royal officers from the guards of the door who had sought to send their hand against King Ahasuerus, and the king asked, what was done? What glory and greatness? And the king's youth, his servant, said, nothing was done for him. And the king said, who is in the yard? Why is he asking who's in the yard? He's just curious. Is there anybody around for me to consult?
He's still fearful.
He's afraid. Who? This is the middle of the night. Right? He's unable to sleep. It's the middle of the night. Who is outside in my yard in the middle of the night? And the answer is Haman. Tell me something now. When Ahasuerus says... when Ahasuerus gives the instruction that Haman should be the one to lead Mordechai through the streets. Mordechai is known by everybody to be a Jew. Ahasuerus knows that Haman wants the Jews dead. What do you think he's doing by having Haman, second in command in the entire kingdom, be the one to lead Mordechai through the streets with this proclamation? What's he doing?
He's putting Haman in his right place.
He's putting Haman in his place. He is afraid that Haman has gotten a little too big. And so he wants specifically to lower him. What else? What is he afraid of from Haman? Not just that Haman has become big, but what else? Yeah, that there's something going on between Haman and Esther. Because Esther invited Haman to the party.
Esther invited, but why is Haman hanging around in the middle of the night?
Right. Exactly. So now, chapter 7... second party, Esther outs Haman. She says, he wants to kill me, right? Haman pleads with Esther. Ahasuerus can't figure out what's going on at this point because I thought that there was something going on between Haman and Esther, and now it turns out that Esther says Haman wants to kill her, and he steps out to the palace garden, right, which I guess they've been cleaned up from the party. He steps out to the garden, he comes back inside, and Haman is there falling on the bed of Esther. Take a look at source number 11, right? Esther said, a foe and enemy is this wicked Haman. Haman was shocked before the king and queen. The king arose in his anger from the feast of wine to the palace garden. Haman stood to seek his life from Queen Esther. He sees he's in trouble. King comes back. Haman is falling on the bed on which Esther was, and he says, would you also take the queen with me in the house? And at that point, Haman's face was covered, which can be explained either as it went dark, like he knows he's done, or I've actually seen it explained that there was a practice that when the king was angry at somebody, they would cover the person's face. Like the king shouldn't have to see him. And so you can imagine, like, the attendants are there, and they put the cover over Haman's face at this point. And at this point, Ahasuerus decides to kill his lead advisor. Right? He's killing the second in command in his kingdom, again, out of his fear. There's a lot more in this story, but that's going to suffice for layer one. Layer two, this is where, to me, things get more interesting. In layer one, you just read the text, and if you have an eye towards looking for fear, you can see it. But there's more going on here. Why was Esther selected to be the queen?
She was beautiful.
Oh, it's such a nice story. She was beautiful. Come on. Why is Esther selected?
She was smart.
How would he know that?
Well, she was figuring out what to do.
applicant, whether he knew that or not. There was no real good reason for her to be selected.
Yeah. So it's great for us to say it's God's hand. We have the Midrashim about how she was given Chut Shel Chesed, and that's a very important point. However, take a look at source number 12. And the king loved Esther more than all the women. She bore favor and kindness before him more than all of the young girls. He placed the royal crown on her head, and he made her queen in place of Vashti. You know what I think I see? We're going to see more of this shortly, and we get to layer 3. But to me, the key point is he made her queen.
Yep.
Remember, Esther doesn't tell anybody about her lineage. Why doesn't she tell anybody? Why does Mordechai say, don't tell anybody who you are, that you're a Jew? So I might have said it's because, well, you know, not everybody likes Jews. However, there's an added dimension here. If Ahasuerus is worried about his standing, he's worried about the security of his throne, let him pick someone who's a nobody. Pick somebody who is so embarrassed about their lineage that they won't tell anybody where they come from. That's how she gets the throne. And we'll see more about this in layer 3. There's a Gemara that backs this up.
But she was still beautiful.
She's still beautiful. Don't worry about it. She's great. I'm not taking anything away from Esther. But that's number one. Number two, who did Haman replace as lead advisor? Take a look at source number 13. After these matters, King Ahasuerus, these matters being the plot by Bigtan and Teresh. That's the immediately preceding story. After these matters, King Ahasuerus elevated Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and raised him up, and he placed his seat above all the officers who were with him. And of the king's servants at the royal gate, and I should say all of, sorry, would kneel and bow to Haman, for so the king had instructed for him. Who's he replacing? No, those are just guards of the door. The answer is nobody. There was no predecessor. Ahasuerus just created a position. And the position that he gives him is, you are over everybody else. Who was Haman before this story? Sorry? Just a guy. Just a guy. You just elevated somebody to the position of second in command in your empire, and he didn't hold a position before this. You listed all your big advisors in chapter 1. He wasn't there. There is one medrash that suggests that Memuchan from the first list may be Haman. And there's another medrash that says he's Daniel, so go figure. Haman was a nobody. Who puts a nobody, I feel terrible calling someone a nobody, but it's Haman. Who puts a nobody in charge of the kingdom? I asked for it. You got me, Moish. You got me. All right. Who else? Why? What's the logic? The answer is? He does, exactly, someone who is afraid of threats. So he takes someone who has no standing, who has no power base, and who will therefore be indebted to Ahasuerus. That's what he has accomplished. He puts in somebody who can only be indebted to Ahasuerus for having done this on his behalf. That's a move of somebody who is fearful, and that's why it says, after these events, it's right after the assassination attempt. He says, I need to make sure that all the people who are close to me owe me. Not only that, go to the end of the book. There's a passage that people completely ignore because they're at the end already and you stop grogging already and they're looking, you know, where's the blessing that I'm supposed to recite in the book? Take a look at source number 14. The beginning of chapter 10. And King Ahasuerus levied a tax upon the land and the islands of the sea. What in the world is that doing in the book of Esther? What's that doing there? It's after the Jews have defended themselves and they made their celebration and they created the celebration for all time. And then Ahasuerus made a tax. And all of his deeds of strength and might, that's his deeds, Ahasuerus's deeds, and the explication of the greatness of Mordechai, who was elevated by the king, are recorded in the book of the accounts of days of the kings of Media and Persia. What is this doing here? First of all, why the tax? pays for the parties. Pays for all the parties. It's a reassertion of control. Mas is not even a financial tax necessarily. Mas is often a labor tax in which different nations under your control have to send populations to do work. That's often what a mas is. It isn't necessarily cash. This is a reassertion of control over everybody under his command, and hence the need for the book to conclude by mentioning the might and strength of Ahasuerus, which has nothing to do with the story. But if you're going to publish this in the Persian Empire, you bet this is showing up in the story. You had better include that, because otherwise you will be censored fast, and censorship doesn't mean they take away all the copies of your book. Moish. I know, but I'm not going anywhere beyond it.
But it's the one thing Trump achieved in his first year of office was reform of tax. What does that mean?
I'm not going there. Okay. Layer three.
Do we have any accounts of Medea Persia? Like he said, it's recorded in the Book of Accounts of the days of.
Yeah. So we do have accounts from that period. Largely written by the Greeks. Herodotus, the Greek historian, did a lot in terms of Persian history. He's not quite contemporary. He's a little later. But we do have accounts from that point, because that's the period when you start to really see written records of history recorded and preserved.
Is any of this corroborated? Like, that's
a fair. Right, so that's a lot harder. There's a book that came out, which people have emailed me about it, and I have heard of it, and I know the author. Rabbi Yehuda Landi, something like the Land of Persia, or Persia of the Torah, Persia of the Bible, something like that, where he tries to put together pieces of evidence. If you look for it, his last name is spelled L-A-N-D-Y. I think someone brought it in a while ago.
That's called Purim and, I think, Purim and Archaeology, something like that.
Is it? Okay. I don't know, if you look up Yehuda Landi, you'll find it. Thank you. Okay, so this is your second layer, right? Less obvious examples of Ahasuerus' fear. But now I want to show you how the Midrash picks up on this motivation of fear and amplifies it. And the first stop is what Morris mentioned towards the beginning when we talked about Vashti. Why is it that Ahasuerus needs to make this into an international incident? So take a look at source number 15. And the king was enraged. Says the Talmud, why did her refusal so incite him? Rava explained, she sent a message to him. Stable boy of my father. My father drank the equivalent of 1,000 others, which is based on a verse in Daniel, and did not become intoxicated. But you have become foolish with your wine. Immediately, and his anger burned in him. What the Talmud is picking up on here is the idea that Ahasuerus was not royal by lineage. And in fact, it was Vashti who was the royal one. And Vashti is a descendant of the Babylonian king. Which king is not so clear. It would seem to be Belshazzar. But she's a descendant of the Babylonian king. And he only gained his power as a function of his marriage to her. That's the idea.
He had a better bloodline.
Which is why, if you take a look back at source number 5, you'll note the king asks the council of his wise men regarding what to do, Bamalka Vashti, what to do with Queen Vashti, right? But take a look at the instruction for the proclamation. What is she called? Just Vashti. Right? The point is to try to remove from her that authority that she brings to the table, that she is, in fact, the queen. It's all about this. It's all about this standing that she has, and he does not. That's number one. Number two, the choice of anonymous Esther. So I already told you my belief that he picks Esther because she specifically doesn't claim any great lineage. Take a look at what the Talmud does with it in source number 16. When the verse says, and Esther bore favor in the eyes of all who saw her, Rabbi Elazar said, this teaches that she appeared to each one as though she was from his nation. Each person looked at her and said, yeah, she's one of mine. That's the way that her non-explanation of her own lineage helps her gain the favor of everybody who sees her, and most important, of Ahasuerus. Everybody thinks that she will be loyal to them. Haman, I already told you that he didn't appear in the beginning of the book, and suddenly he's elevated. Talmud picks up on that in source number 17. We have learned Haman was the barber of Kfar Kartzom for 22 years. That was his job. He was a barber. Now, we don't have textual evidence within the book that he's a barber. You can't. This isn't one of those midrashim where you can see something in the text that shows he has, you know, a history cutting hair. The idea is that this is not, apologies to anybody here who is in, you know, anything aesthetic, but this was not considered a high-ranking position in the kingdom. They're highlighting his lack of background because that's what leads to his selection. And then the motivation to get rid of the Jews. The Talmud builds on Haman's claim. Take a look at source number 18, where it breaks down Haman's charges line by line. Haman says, and their law is different from that of any other nation. They do not eat of ours, they do not marry of ours, they do not marry theirs to us. Right? Which is true. Right? It's fundamentally true.
Except in the case of Esther.
Esther. But he didn't know that at the time. But they won't eat our food, they won't marry among us. They do not practice the king's laws, said Haman. They spend the entire year in today is Shabbos, today is Pesach. Right? We have way more holidays. And it is not worthwhile for the king to let them be, for they eat and drink and mock the throne. And even if a fly would fall into the cup of one of them, he would throw out the fly and drink it. But if my master, the king, would touch the cup of one of them, he would throw it on the ground and he would not drink it. What's he doing? What's the Talmud doing here? It's trying to explain Ahasuerus' fear. Why is he so afraid? What is it that's driving him in each of his moves? Or it's trying to highlight the way that the fear makes him act. So he's motivated to destroy the Jews because of this claim that they're mocking and degrading him. Then, his reward for Mordechai. His decision that Mordechai should be paraded through the city, or even before that, his decision to read out the Chronicles, actually. Source number 19. A thought fell into his mind, the mind of Ahasuerus. He said, what is this that Esther invited Haman? Perhaps they're taking counsel against that man to kill him. That man being a euphemism. What he means is against myself. That's why I put it in quotes. They're taking counsel against me. And then he said, well, if so, isn't there anyone who likes me who will tell me? Don't I have allies? And then he said, perhaps there's someone who benefited me and I didn't pay him back. And so people refrain from revealing this to me. And so Ahasuerus says, read through the Chronicles and tell me, is there anybody I didn't reward? And that's why people are looking at this. You know, people may be aware that there's a plot against me, but they're not going to tell me because they are because they know I don't reward people who do good things for me. And so he decides he's going to hang Haman. When he finds out about the plot, when Esther tells him that that Haman wants to kill her, at that point, he's ready to hang Haman. He has suspected Haman already from this point of the story. Right? He suspected Haman from the point where she invited him to the party. The suspicion only grew when he discovered Haman outside his throne room in the middle of the night. And then to find out that he is actually a threat to Esther and a threat to Mordechai to boot. Take a look at source number 20. The king arose in his anger from the feast of wine to the palace garden, and the king returned from the palace garden to the room of the feast of wine. Just as he rose in anger, so he returned in anger. For he went and found the ministering malachim, angels, in the guise of men, uprooting the trees of the orchard. And he went out to the garden, and he didn't calm down. Why didn't he calm down? Because he went out and found that people were destroying his garden. But they're not people, they're angels. And he said to them, what are you doing? And they said, Haman instructed us. That's not true. Let's just get that straight. But that's why that's the point. The point is to make sure that he doesn't lose his anger against Haman. This is a mercurial king. Right? He can get angry and then he can forget his anger. You want to make sure he stays angry. So he goes down to the palace and to the garden. He finds an additional provocation. He entered his palace, and Haman was falling on the bed on which Esther was. To which they ask, the wording is funny in the text. It says he was falling. That's literally the word. In the Hebrew, it's Bahaman no fail, where it should have said Bahaman nafal, that Haman had fallen on the bed. Because presumably he fell right away. Not he's falling now. Again, malachim are involved. Angels are involved. Rabbi Elazar said this teaches that a malach came and knocked him down onto the bed. He wasn't going to make that move. Haman was not foolish enough to do that. However, the malach helps him along in order to set up the rage of Ahasuerus. So what this is really showing, and what I try to show a little quickly in 15 to 20, is that the sages are cognizant of this. This goes back to our basic point about how kings operate in Tanakh. We look to see what it is that drives these conspiracies and plots and actions. And in the first case with Darius, it was being railroaded by his court. The second one, he's being manipulated by God and Cyrus. Here, it's simply fear and anxiety, which God is willing to play with. I just wanted to make one more point. I see a couple of hands, but I want to see if I can get one more point in the next 3 minutes. The fear here is seen by Tanakh as coming from God in order to make things happen, but the text hides it in ways that it doesn't hide God's hand elsewhere in Tanakh. Right? When we read about Cyrus, it said, "Hey, ir Hashem et rucho." It said that God actually manipulated him, that God awakened his spirit. Here, it doesn't say anything about God, right? How many times does God's name appear in this book? Zero. So what's going on here, I think, is a very important point in general about this book. Some have made the argument that the reason why God is omitted is, again, because it's in the Persian Empire, and you don't want to offend them by crediting things to our God. But I think fundamentally you're looking at two different kinds of books in Tanakh. You have the book of Shoftim, of Judges, which describes everything that happens for us as a function of God. Every event that takes place, God made this happen. And it really hides all of the different human motivations. And then you have the book of Esther that goes the other way around. And it hides the divine hand, leaving it to Midrash to try to spell things out and to amplify the ideas that are there. But fundamentally, the text leaves it to us to recognize the hand of God within the story and to see it on this to see it on this deeper level. There were a couple of hands. Nancy.
I wondered if the 19
yeah.
thought fell into this.
Right. The a thought fell actually is. It is nafal. It is nafal. So you think also the thought is being planted in his mind. It's a good idea. Thank you. It is a good idea. Others? Okay, then thank you very much. Next week, the last in our series is King Artaxasta. He is the one who licenses Ezra and Nehemiah to come back to Israel with full powers to build the temple, to reinforce the walls, to promote Judaism. And we'll have to talk about what motivated him. So tune in next week. Thank you. Yes, Andy.